I'm Paula Apsell. I'm the senior executive producer of the PBS science series Nova. I've been making science films for more than 30 years, and it's depressing that after all this time, finding female scientists to be in our programs still entails a special search. Will that always be the case? Will we ever see real gender parity in science and engineering? And as this panel will ask, why should we care? I'm honored to be here this morning with five amazing women who've reached the top of their fields in academia, corporate America, and research science. But I'm also stymied by the fact that this panel only lasts an hour. I could talk to each of these women for a whole day or more. So we're going to streamline the process. I'm going to ask each of you to introduce yourself and then to give us a little bit of an anecdote or a personal story of your journey to the top in science, or in the case of Sylvia and Edie, to the bottom. So why don't we start with Kim?
Yes. I'm Kim Bottomley. I'm currently the president of Wellesley College. Before I came to Wellesley, I spent 27 years at Yale University. I was on the faculty there. I'm a scientist. I was my lab was located in the medical school, the Yale Medical School, and I'm an immunobiologist. And so my major field of interest is really to understand the basic mechanisms that underlie asthmatic and allergic responses. Part of my time at Yale was spent in the provost's office, and in that job, the deputy provost, I was a deputy provost for science, technology, and faculty development. So I was one of the first people to have the job of faculty development, and I spent a lot of my time thinking about how to support faculty and also how to diversify the faculty at Yale. If I think about an anecdote, I guess the most relevant one to me, and perhaps the one that I've thought about the most recently, has to do with the fact that about 4 or 5 years ago, my PhD advisor invited four of his advisees, or mentors, he was our mentor for graduate school, to join him for a reunion in New York City. And all of the advisees were women. And we had a wonderful weekend with this wonderful man. And during the course of the weekend, the four women had an opportunity to sit down together. We were all drinking martinis and comparing notes about our youth. We hadn't seen each other for a while. And one of them said something very interesting, which is that we were so lucky to have had this man as our advisor, because he was the only man in the department who allowed women in his laboratory. And the amazing thing about that statement is that I didn't know that. And so the point of the story is that even though I had chosen an advisor who was, I thought, the best advisor in the department, and I had the sort of, I was smart enough and I had enough ambition and determination to become a scientist, that my life as a graduate student really depended on luck. Luck that I had found this man, who was the only man in the department who was willing to take women on as advisees. And so I often think that my success depended early on luck. And my mantra now, as people at Wellesley will tell you, is that women should not have to depend on luck. Thanks.
Well, I say I'm into that. Eve, why don't we move on to you?
Good morning. My name is Eve Higginbotham, and I'm currently the Senior Vice President and Executive Dean for Health Sciences at Howard University. This is a position that I've only held for the last 6 months. As I go through my brief bio, I think what is evident is that in order to move up the academic ladder, I had to keep changing institutions. So I started my academic career at University of Illinois, University of Michigan, as an assistant dean for faculty affairs, and then I was at University of Maryland as a department chair. I'm an ophthalmologist and a glaucoma specialist. And I was department chair for 12 years, if you think I cannot keep a job for longer than five. And after that, I went on to be dean at Morehouse School of Medicine in Atlanta, Georgia. And now I'm at Howard University, where I'm in charge of all the health sciences. I report to the president, and at this point, I'm the highest ranking woman at that institution. And certainly, I think it's an opportunity to change the culture. I suppose my anecdote is that I couldn't have done any of this without my supportive husband, who's here. And we certainly have moved a lot. He certainly had to make a sacrifice in his own career in order to help support mine. So that's very critical. When I was finishing my fellowship at Massachusetts Eye and Ear Infirmary, after having graduated from MIT with a master's and a bachelor's and going to Harvard Medical School and having this wonderful training at Mass Eye and Ear, my husband will tell you that I had no job offers except for one. My colleagues who were male at the time were getting three or four job offers for their first academic position. I had one job offer, and ultimately, because I actually thought I wasn't going to be hired. And I think that's just an indication of how, you know, we as a society haven't really changed in terms of gender as well as ethnicity as it relates to expectations of what people can bring to an organization. And it just so happens that one job offer was with the best department chair I could have ever have connected with, and there was some luck in that, Dr. Morton Goldberg, and he really gave me a great start for my career at University of Illinois.
That story, it's heartening that there was someone, but very depressing. I think maybe we need martinis early. Edie, let's move on to you.
I'm Dr. Edie Witter. I'm the CEO, president, and senior scientist of the Ocean Research and Conservation Organization. It's an organization that I founded to try to help save the ocean that I love. I had a fairly traditional academic background. I got my master's in biochemistry and my PhD in neurobiology, and had a fairly normal career carved out for myself. And then I had the opportunity to make a dive in a diving suit, a deep diving suit called WASP, that could go down to 2,000 feet in the ocean. And I went down in this suit, and I turned out the lights, and I saw the most amazing light show that you could ever imagine. It was bioluminescence, all these amazing creatures in the ocean that make light. And I came away from the experience feeling like it had to be one of the most important phenomena in the ocean, and I couldn't understand why more people weren't studying it. It wasn't that I discovered it. I mean, that's why I turned out the lights. I knew I'd see it, but I just wasn't prepared for how much there was. And so I've been studying it ever since. And it set me on a course into a very male-dominated field, being a woman at sea on oceanographic vessels. I was often the only woman at sea. And at those early days, I'm sure, as Sylvia knows, there were many superstitions about how unlucky it was to have a woman on a ship. There were also the feeling that a woman on a ship would waste water, because we all take Hollywood showers, of course, and back in those days, they had to carry all of the fresh water that they were going to use. They didn't manufacture it at sea the way we do now. So I got to the point where I could take a shower in less than a gallon of water. Most people take a shower in over 10 gallons of water. This is because on a ship, people can hear how much water you're using. And so if it becomes an issue and they're running out of water, I don't want them all pointing and looking at me. So the first time I went on the British ship Discovery, that's a very big research vessel, we were going out on a month-long expedition. And it's got like 50 people on board. And they told me when I got there that because I was going to be on board, they had put on an extra 10,000 gallons of water. And I went ballistic, which of course was their point, that they were pushing my buttons, because they had the data to prove it, because they had had a woman on board before, and they had used that much water, because when there's a woman on board, the men take more showers. So the answer to the question, why should we care? Better hygiene.
Good.
So,
how can I follow this?
Hi, I'm Sophie van den Broek. I'm a Chief Technology Officer at Xerox Corporation, as well as the President of the Xerox Innovation Group, which is the 5 global research centers. We have one in India, in France, in Canada, PARC, the Palo Alto Research Center on the West Coast, and in Rochester, New York, as well as a joint venture with Fuji Xerox, where we do research in Tokyo. I came to the U.S. 25 years ago after I got my master's degree in electromechanical engineering. I came to do a PhD in microelectronics. And at that point in time, the U.S. was really a magnet for people in Europe that wanted to come here to study, and because this was a center of innovation and research. And then I worked at IBM Research, and after that joined Xerox Corporation and had different jobs in Xerox. At one point, about 10 years ago, Xerox, we had a hard time. We were on the verge of bankruptcy. Right now, we're making over $1 billion in profit a year, so we went through that. But at that point in time, this is my anecdote, the headhunters were calling, and so I was not yet CTO, and I had an opportunity to become CTO in a different company, a job which I took, and so I jumped ship, went to this other company, and that was a huge eye-opener for me, because they basically had never seen a woman in a senior engineering role before, and I was in a completely non-diverse environment, and that's when I realized how lucky I was at Xerox, where our CEO, Anne Mulcahy, is a woman, or at the time it was Anne. Now we have Ursula Burns, who's an African-American woman. We have women in many leadership roles. We have been lucky that we've been able to hire 40% of our new engineers are women. So you don't realize, I just didn't realize how good Xerox was, and so when they called me asking if I wanted to come back, I said yes, tomorrow, which was after my year and a half little sabbatical. And so it just made me realize how important it is that you go work for a company where you really don't need to be a trailblazer. I believe trailblazers are amazing, and I was trailblazer in multiple times throughout my career, but if you don't have to be, it just makes life so much easier. Yeah.
Sylvie.
My luck began with having parents who didn't object to the idea that I, as a girl, could do the same things that my brothers could do. I could go out and get wet and muddy and, you know, explore the woods nearby. And it was okay. And although when I quite naturally went into science because that's what I, as a little kid, wanted to do, I was advised by my loving parents that they didn't know how I was going to make a living because that's not what girls do. That I could be a teacher, I could be a secretary, I might be a nurse, or I could be something really exciting, an airline stewardess. Wow, see the world. But they didn't object. In fact, they were there all the way when I just stuck with it and took classes that led to a bachelor's and a master's and PhD and, well, botany, because I wanted to be a zoologist, but they killed animals instead of looking at live animals. You looked at dead animals, and I didn't want to go out and kill birds and fish and things. So as a botanist, I had the luck of being right there at a time that one of my colleagues at Duke University, who was much better qualified, actually, than I was, to take a role as the botanist on an expedition to the Indian Ocean. This was 1964. Oh. Wow. Before there were women astronauts or whatever. And having a woman aboard a ship, as Edie knows, was considered bad luck. I mean, the ship might sink, or I didn't get into the water thing. But it was after it was sort of a done deal that I was going to go that it was realized I would be the only woman on board with 70 guys. Only 12 scientists in all, and there was concern of whether it would be okay. I thought it was really okay. I mean, come on. But when we got to Mombasa, our port of departure, the Mombasa Daily Times sent a reporter out to discuss what we were planning to do. And the 12 of us, the scientists, poured our hearts out about what we expected to do during the month that we were going to explore the Indian Ocean in many places for the first time, using diving techniques, scuba in the Indian Ocean, 1964. But the headline the next day dismissed most of what was said, and it said, "Sylvia sails away with 70 men." And the bottom line was, "But she expects no problems." The only problem really was that we were trying to explore the ocean sitting up on the top, and we didn't have little submarines such as what Edie described, we're still scrabbling to get down to the bottom in many ways. But that was one of the headlines that has sort of marked whatever it is that has caused me to be whatever it is that I am. Now explorer in residence at the National Geographic. But along the way, I also decided that one way to become the CEO of a company is to start the company. I've done it 3 times. My daughter and son-in-law now own and operate the 3rd one of these little ventures that I started to design and develop equipment to try to get to the bottom, if you will, to solve the problems. One of the great things about being in this country is even girls can do this. You can convince the people who are out there who share your vision to get behind an idea and one way or the other make it happen. I also had a chance to, again, not because it was a given, but because it was an idea that seemed the right thing to do, to learn the predecessor to the WASP suit that Edie described, a walking suit, in this case a flying suit for Edie. This system is called JIM, J-I-M, named after the first person willing to put one on. Looks like a walking refrigerator, like the an astronaut suit or a Michelin man suit, whatever. That I was working on a project with the National Geographic for a book called Exploring the Deep Frontier, and all the history of diving, the history of exploration. But there was one aspect that was just beginning to be developed, and that was the use of these atmospheric diving suits that were typically lowered on a tether from the surface and allowed people to go more than 1,000 feet beneath the surface to go places that holding your breath would be really tough, or even using scuba, it's hard to do. I mean, you could go to maybe 100 feet, even compressed mixes of gases take people to 1,000 feet or so, but long decompressions. And with a diving suit like this, as Edie knows, atmospheric diving, same pressure you have here in this room. So we talked ocean engineering into letting this suit be used to give me a chance to see what it was like to go diving in this off the coast of Hawaii, to explore the ocean with the capacity to just go there on my own. Well, it's a kind of a long story, and I'll cut to the chase and say that it was successful, and the news picked it up as a kind of a big deal. The headline was, "Brave Mom Dives to 1,000 Feet." And this got put on the refrigerator, the headline. It was on the centerfold of the Star, the magazine, and you find it in supermarkets everywhere. So my kids say if things go a little south sometimes, it's okay, Mom, just be brave.
That's a great story. I think it's clear that these women are, in Sophie's words, trailblazers. But what's the situation for girls today? A 2007 National Academies report says that with each step up the academic ladder, from high school to full professor, the representation of women in science and engineering drops. So is this a retention problem? Is it a problem that girls just aren't getting interested in science? What is the problem for girls today in science and engineering?
So I think there's a problem at almost every stage. I think it has a lot to do with education, personally. And I think if we just go back for a moment to the title of this session, which is Women in the Cutting Edge of Science, Why Do We Care? We have to care. You know, our world depends on having the talent, especially in this country, to be competitive in science and technology and innovation. That couldn't be more clearly shown than at this particular Aspen Institute Aspen Ideas Festival. If we leave half of the talent pool, if we leave women and minorities out of that, we are going to be missing part of that talent pool. So we need to figure out a way to be sure women are represented at absolutely every level of this enterprise. So women have to be, we have to think about ways in which we can inspire women to want to go into science. We have to educate them to be successful in science. They have to be promoted in ways that allows them to have leadership potential to bring on the new women and men that will really keep us competitive. So if I just look at what I know best, which is higher education, I think what I would say is that there are things that we need to do, and if I go back to my own anecdote, to be sure that women don't just have to be or don't have to depend on luck in order to make it in science. And I would just say, for instance, we need to be sure in colleges and universities that we are educating women for success in science. That seems like sort of a straightforward thing. You know, we have classes, they're rigorous. We want to make sure that they can go, women can go on to graduate school and can be successful in graduate school. And as we are able to offer educational opportunities to more people to come to college, the unevenness in the background of the women that we take in, for instance, in Wellesley College or at other colleges, has increased because students don't take 4 years of science necessarily in high school. The science teachers are an uneven quality in high school. So making sure that women get the science that they need means their access to the courses in college needs to be equitable in a way in entering college, and we all have to work at that. I think we need to inspire women to be scientists by letting them be scientists in college. There's nothing more exciting, and the data bear this out, than going into a laboratory early during in your career, in your first year as a student, and working with a professor. There's something very stimulating about that. We know from talking to our own alums at Wellesley College and at other schools that that was a defining moment for them to become go on and to major in science and then to go on to become a PhD. So letting them be scientists. Mm-hmm. One of the critical things I think we need to do more of, and it really comes back to things that we've talked about as a group, is that we need to make sure women understand that science is really a field for them. And by that means they have to understand the stereotypes that are out there. So we as scientists have been very good about advertising that there's been a problem for science and women in science, so that now the whole world recognizes that. That has a downside side for women who are coming along in the sciences, or young girls who are thinking, oh my gosh, science is a really complicated place for a woman to be.
But do we have to do that when they're in junior high and elementary school?
I think we need to do it at every stage. We need to talk about the stereotypes. Mm-hmm. What's it really based on? And to dismiss that in some way that girls and women can understand.
Just chime in.
I think it starts in middle school. I think little girls are very interested in science, in exploring, but it's really in middle school where they lose it because of the pressure from their peers. In fact, if I may, it should take a minute, but my daughter, when she was 16, wrote an essay around that topic, and what she said is the nerdy Einstein resembling image of a scientist is etched into the brains of almost every child. The stereotype has morphed into others, such as women being inferior to men in science, and starting when they're born, girls are discouraged explicitly from going into fields such as physics, chemistry, and engineering. And then she goes on, starting when I was little, my parents, both engineers, were doing the opposite, and I was giving numerous of math workbooks, computer games, etc., doing chemical experiments. So it is really, I mean, that's where a lot of kids lose it, because girls can be the smart kids in school and And by the way, I'm very happy to say that just last month she graduated with an engineering degree from Cornell University. And so, of course, her mom talked herself and two of her girlfriends into studying engineering, and they're all very successful. They love what they do. But it is really this stereotypical image of Einstein and nerdy, and then the pressure they get in the classrooms.
I think it's time that we also debunk the notion that it's not nature, but it is really the environment and nurture. And
so we have to.
Excuse me?
It starts very early.
Yeah, it starts very early. Yeah. So girls have the same aptitude as boys, and we certainly see the gap in math scores significantly reduce, even equal in high school. So the whole notion that girls don't have the same aptitude needs to be totally erased from the American mindset. It's also the American culture that needs to reinforce the fact that the definition of a scientist is really not the Einstein that is necessarily the nerdy figure that some may think, but it's really you know, those of us who are sitting here on this panel, a much broader identity.
Nothing wrong with being nerdy.
Yes. The Academy of Arts and Sciences recently commissioned, or at least actually held, two or three seminars, because they're asking the question, what does the public think about scientists? And one of the interesting findings in this conversation was that when you ask the public what their ideal of a scientist is, there are three names that come up. There's Einstein, so I think that certainly rises to the top. But also Bill Gates, I don't think he's here, and Bob Gore.
Al Gore.
So all three men, not all scientists. But yeah. Even America has this misunderstanding of what a scientist is. So I think we really do need to change the culture. We need to set the expectations. We need to have role models out there. I mean, as an African American, I can certainly attest to the isolation that one feels when you're the only one, particularly given the paucity of African Americans in science as well as women. So I think there are great opportunities for us to change the climate of these.
It isn't just science, though. When you go into, I don't know whether any of you go into Toys R Us, but I have grandkids, so I do sometimes. And they're pink aisles. They're blue aisles. The blue aisles have really cool things. I mean, really, the inspire what you can be. You can be anything. You can be these, you know, pilots. You can be doctors. You can be all these fascinating things for the blue column to do. The pink, you know, it's all about frilly, fluffy mirrors and costumes and, oh, yeah, there's some kitchen appliances that girls can use.
Even though Barbie is changing, and she does.
Yeah, Barbie's done actually a great service in showing. But nonetheless, we have a culture. If you look at any of the cartoons that are in there, I mean, I do because, again, I have two of my grandsons with their mom and dad live with me. So I've had a new education about what, from the time these little munchkins were just a few months old to where they are today as budding teenagers, that our culture really still, despite all the pluses, all the good news, the girls are the ones that get saved by the heroes in these adventure stories.
So I think actually we can't get away with it on this panel without touching upon what I think we called yesterday, and you brought it up slightly today, the nature-nurture issue, or what you called the Larry Summers thing. So let's delve right into it. That the idea that the invisible force holding up the glass ceiling in science, engineering, and math is that women are just not as smart, particularly at the far end of the bell curve, so I could say as brilliant. This kind of came on the horizon a couple of years ago, long after I think everybody had kind of discounted it and wasn't thinking about it, and now I believe that it's an issue again. So I'd just like to know what you would make of that and how we can finally put that to rest, if it's not true.
Well, unfortunately, it's still embedded in the hearts and minds of the generation of individuals that are still in power in academia, at least, I'll say that. And so we still, we need to change the culture by increasing the critical mass of women who are doing great things in science. And to do that, we need to at least get 20% of the academy in academia, if you will, to be women leaders and others who are more inclusive, more transparent, and are willing to change the institutional policies that are more conducive to the life, the biological clock of a woman that really is at the same point in the career where tenure is being considered, making tenure decisions at a longer point in time, or a more distant point in time than where it is now. It certainly is evident that it makes sense to make that investment, because America can't afford to lose in the competitive race of being at the highest level of a STEM.
I also think that we want to be diversifying our knowledge pool and our brain pool as much as possible. I mean, Sir Ken Robinson spoke yesterday about the incredible need for creativity in order to be able to address the problems that we're facing on this planet. And clearly, it doesn't make sense. You want people to be thinking, you want people that can think outside the box. You don't want the people that created the problems we have right now trying to find the solutions. You need people that think differently, actually. And it is true, women think differently than men. It's been shown, you know, back from my neurobiology training, it's known that women have more neural traffic on the corpus callosum. We actually are better multitaskers than men. We are turning into a multitasking society.
I think we all kind of know that.
But I think there's another issue here, which is that I completely agree with both of you in the sense, in this very important sense. You know, there have been, for each of us in our careers, there have been obstacles pretty much almost on a daily basis of being the only woman, the pioneer, and whatever we were doing. And I look at the Larry Summers comment and the subsequent response to that is really just another obstacle. And we got past this, all of us, by in some senses not noticing those obstacles and just getting on with what we knew was important to do. And I think this is a moment when we need to do that as well. So that's point number one. Point number two is that as a scientist, and one who's done a lot of bench work and who's been very data-driven and everything that I have done, and I tend to be a person who says, when I have a problem, what are all the pieces of information I need to gather together in order to make decisions about that? I look at the kinds of data that are out there that are supporting what people think is sort of the point that Larry Summers has made. And what you find is there's a lot of correlative data. So, you know, you do an MRI on men and women while they're solving a math problem, and men and women's MRIs and their brains light up differently. And therefore, you make a conclusion that there's a difference in the innate ability. Now, that's a huge correlative leap, that the therefore. I think that the whole thing about the bell curve and the ends, which it has to do all with SAT scores, is really just another one of those things. You have many more men who are at the high score level on the SATs. Are those people going to be better scientists? And I think the only way you could actually ask the question in a legitimate way would be to say, take all the great scientists that are out there, men and women, and ask, how did they score on the SAT? Now, we may find out, we get an answer we don't like. But you need to do the experiment and get the data to find that out, and we haven't been willing to do that.
You told us a great story yesterday about these ultra-brilliant guys in a lab that you were in when you started out, so I'd like you to tell that. We won't tell out of this room. What's said in the room stays in
and
the
room.
It's being taped.
Oh, the camera's on me. So I've always noticed this. I'm sure all of you have noticed this as well. When I was working in during one of my periods of time in a training environment, I was very impressed, and I was the only woman in this particular training environment for a period of time. I was very impressed that all the men around me were incredibly smart. I'm sure they were ones that scored out there in those tails. Very, very smart, very, very quick, really fun to interact with, but really brilliant people. And I was I don't know, wasn't that maybe 10 years ago, I thought back on those people that I trained with. We were all immunologists. We were all going on in our careers and wondered where they were and what they were doing. And not one of them was a top scientist. It was hard to find them, actually, in the literature. So it takes more than just being really, really smart and knowing that you're smart in order to sort of make it in the world of science.
Could I just ask, too, who puts the SAT test together and what do they test?
Exactly.
Yes, exactly.
Because it may not be a real measure of what makes a scientist or any other field of endeavor. It's a test, but it's just a test. It's just one gauge that is put together somehow by somebody.
Yeah.
And
yes,
I think the answer to my answer to the question anyway, why does it matter, is that diversity matters. You need people who have a special talent over here that may not appear in the tests at all, to look from the sidelines and say, well, but this is the way to go, isn't it? And then to, you know, find other points of view or other talents that are sometimes really tricky to measure in standard techniques, or that you don't actually sometimes get in formal classes. It may come from a very different perspective, like
Sophie,
being a mom. It could matter.
You're in the corporate world, and I'd like to know where there are, you know, big labs who have to have a bottom line
as
well as an understanding of how the world works. Are there special skills that you feel that women bring to these technical tasks that perhaps are very important in and of themselves?
Yeah, I think especially leading research at Xerox, where it's both, we say innovation is both creativity as well as entrepreneurship, right? You have to have an amazing idea, work with teams of people to create and come up with these ideas, and then work with your whole value chain to really influence and bring it to market. And what we have learned is that pulling together diverse teams of people just makes a lot of business sense. I mean, our global customers are from all different cultures. They're men, they're women, they're different backgrounds. So the creativity, I mean, if you have all people who look and feel the same in a room, you're going to come up with products that are really targeted to this type of people also. So really creating a diverse teams is very important. Again, number one, our customers are very diverse. Number two, if you have already diverse organizations, it's much easier to really hire top-notch people. As I briefly mentioned before, we have been able to hire about 40% of our engineers are women today, more than 10% African-American, more than 10% Hispanic. We try to create an environment where everybody can truly be themselves at work. And then number three, indeed, women bring this natural capability of bringing people on board and bringing people in the boat with them instead of more the competitive nature. They really are better at forming networks, etc. And I think, why do we care that women study engineering and science? It is just extremely important. As I mentioned, I mean, in companies like Xerox, we have a hard time to find PhD-level experts in the tough technical fields to make these advanced products that we're working on, or to solve the big problems, as you mentioned, whether it's climate change, or advanced medical devices, or security-related issues. You need to have top-notch scientists. And in the past, they would come from all over the world to work here and stay here. Now they go back home, many of them. In the past, the United States was number 3 in the number of high school students that went on to study engineering. Right now we're number 20. We're close to 20. Just in 2 decades, that's how we dropped. And so if you want to maintain a nation where a lot of innovation happens, new jobs are created, we're at the head of the world in inventing and innovating, we have to be able to attract the people to come here, as well as have 50% of the population participate. It's extremely important.
So I'm just going to ask one more question. You should prepare your questions, and there'll be some roving mics around. You should wait till the mic comes from you. My question is, one of the reasons I got interested in this whole issue is because I was moving one year, and I had a young woman come to my house, and she was helping me organize my move because I was working and didn't have time to do it. And I found out that she had just finished a postdoc at Harvard in molecular biology. Clearly a brilliant young woman, And I asked her why she had decided to leave science, and she said, I didn't feel I could have a normal life. last year, three women won the Nobel Prize. Carol Greider, when she got the call from Stockholm, she was folding the laundry. Do you think this works two ways? Do family responsibilities, do you think, hold women back in science? Or is it the perception of the powers that be in science that women will be too devoted to their family to devote, put in the hours in the lab that they need to do great work? Or is it that women themselves fear that they might not be able to maintain a family life and at the same time do what they need to do? That's a complicated question, but I'd really like to hear your views on it, both in academia and in corporate world. And what can universities and what can corporations do to enable people to be both great scientists and have a good life as well?
It's definitely a factor. I mean, there was one survey in academia where they asked scientists in the lab, how many of you are actually involved in caregiving and in family responsibilities? 56% of the women attested to that significant responsibility versus 28% of men. So it's definitely a factor. The other thing that needs to be debunked in terms of the mystery of who takes time off more, men versus women. Up until the age of 45, women certainly will have time taken off because of their responsibilities, family responsibilities. Whereas after the age of 45, men have more issues with sick leave and chronic diseases. And so you don't hear about the other half of the statistic. There's always that perception that it's really more women. So I would say in academia, as I mentioned earlier, elongating the tenure clock is one significant benefit that would help women. Also valuing team-based medicine. Everything that we're doing now in the health sciences has to be team-based, interdisciplinary. And those are skills that women certainly have developed much more so than men. So I think we need to value those sorts of skills in promotion and tenure decision, as well as provide on-site daycare. But that's not the only answer. It's really the culture that really needs to recognize that everyone has responsibilities outside of the work life, and women certainly carry most of those responsibilities before the age of 45.
It's really challenging in academia because there are tenure track, there are things, there are milestones along the way that if you miss them, you know, you're left behind. And it's, I mean, I experienced it personally, was told when I was a graduate student at Duke, when I applied for a teaching assistantship, which I needed to help my expenses to go through, I was told flat out that while I was certainly qualified, I was just going to get married and have kids, and it would be wasted on me. So there are guys who would make better use of that assistantship. I mean, they would never say that today. Oh, my gosh. But back then, but the attitude
is... But they
is,
might feel it or think it.
Yeah.
Sophie, right. How do you handle it at Xerox? Well, you have a bottom line to worry about as well.
It caused me to be creative. Yeah. And maybe that's, in a way, the plus side of the pressure. Women have to be more creative about what to do with the family and how to overcome the biases that are there.
Yeah. So I think companies as well as individuals have great responsibility to make sure from a company point of view that you create an environment where women and more men these days have responsibilities helping to raise the kids also, but there is a certain level of flexibility, and that what counts is really what you deliver and not necessarily your FaceTime or how many hours you are at work. I had my first child in grad school, the second one when I was doing research at IBM, and then the third one when I joined Xerox. But I've always had managers that were supportive, and if they were not supportive, I would really make it clear that, yeah, this is what I'm going to deliver. These are the expectations. And then you work. And as an individual trying to manage work-life balance, I mean, there are things that I always followed, like simplify your life as much as possible, delegate as much as possible, accept things that really come when it comes to your kids and your family, and really work somewhere where you can have fun, either whether because you work with colleagues that you really enjoy working with, or the project is really interesting. And then I raised my kids for about 12 years by myself, which was very hard. But if you work for a company that really allows you the flexibility, and as long as you exceed your manager's expectations, is what I tell my team members always, just exceed my expectation. Then I don't care where you do it or how you do it, right? Of course, the challenge is expectations keep rising, but you have to create an environment where really there is a lot of flexibility. And we have official rules and lots of policies that people can actually do that. And if you look at the work balance surveys we do, women, in fact, believe at Xerox, the percentage of women that believe they have achieved work-life balance is close to 80%, while the guys is at 60%. So we now need to work on the opposite problem. How can we make men feel that they really can benefit from all these policies that are in place that also are for them? It's just a higher pressure on them not to necessarily take advantage of that.
So, questions from you. Let's rush and get the mics down here, because we only have a few minutes left.
Hello.
Hello.
This is a fascinating thing for me. I'm now 70 years old. I'm a doctor. I graduated class of 61 from Wellesley, actually. And that's what I wanted to mention. I think that I went then to Harvard Medical School, where I encountered men in the classroom for the first time, and they were so strange and different, and they just ignored us. There were only 8 women out of a class of 160. But I had to say that I had a women's education, a girl's education, from the time I was very little all the way up through medical school, and that led to this feeling of, well, whatever you want to do, of course, go do it. There was no idea of limitation in that education, and I think nowadays we're not really doing that kind of education anymore. We throw the girls in with the boys, we throw the women in with the men, and all those people have these stereotypes. I think that's very, very important to get away from those and to be in a situation like Wellesley where the women did everything because they were the only ones there. They had to do everything. And then I carried that idea through my life and, of course, encountered all the things that you ladies talk about when I was out there. But I think that if you know you can do anything, you have more flexibility, more creativity, and more innovative ideas as you go on. You're not kind of limited to a stereotype.
Yes.
And I think that we have to do all we can around the world to get rid of those stereotypes.
Yes.
Out of the box.
Yeah, if I might comment, that's an excellent comment. There's something very critical about those college years. It's leaky along the way, but the college years are critical for, you know, building self-confidence. If you look at the literature, 75% of PhDs awarded in 1975 to 1992 among African Americans in biology were individuals who graduated from either Spelman College, an all-women's college in Atlanta, Georgia, which is a historically black institution, and Bennett College. So that's an extraordinary statistic. So I think this it works also for historically black institutions, now that I've had the chance to work at 2 institutions where there is a much more nurturing environment and a much more empowering environment during the college years.
Yeah, and I'd follow up on that saying that NSF has a great data bank where you can actually ask what colleges produce graduates that go on to do PhDs in science. And when you do that analysis, you see that liberal arts colleges are disproportionately represented in that. About half of those top 50 colleges are liberal arts colleges, and even though they're quite a bit smaller. So there's something about that small environment which has a high student-faculty engagement that really succeeds in generating enthusiasm for students to go on in science. And, you know, not everybody can go to a liberal arts college or a women's college, which is where, you know, we do a really good job of this. So the question is, how do you export what's good about that and put it into all of our educational venues so that everyone can do this well?
I think we have time for one more question.
Yes. I think that even if a young person is not going through an all-girls school, to me, one of the most important things that a girl must have is someone who, whether it's a parent, a teacher, a mentor, who will nurture that person all the way through. When I was an undergraduate in the early 60s studying biology, I had a wonderful mentor, who a woman who went on to win the Nobel Prize in Medicine, Dr. Rita Levi-Montalcini. And if it had not been for her, I probably wouldn't have remained in biology. Later on in my career, I spent time as a life sciences education consultant working with the youngest audiences, working with children from ages 3 to 8, and spending time especially with the little girls in getting them to understand a little bit more about the immediate environment, the things that lived right around them, and why these things were important. To spark that initial love for trying to understand how things work together. So I really feel that women all along the way, from the littlest ages all the way through, have to have that mentoring. And I would encourage all of you, you're probably already doing this, to be sure that there are internship opportunities for women at your businesses, through your colleges, to be sure that they have those role models and mentors all the way along.
I think mentoring is absolutely critical. I know it was huge for me because I was very fortunate. My mother had a PhD in mathematics, which at a time when women just didn't do such things, and was a fabulous role model for me. And I have been sucked into all kinds of things because of the recognition of the fact that girls need mentors. NSF has supported a bunch of programs to try to mentor young girls, especially in the middle school years, because that's the apparently the most critical age. One of them was called Girls Can, and they had a bunch of women scientists come up to SeaWorld in Orlando, Florida, and they brought in girls, and we gave them talks about marine science, and it all went really great. But they took it to one next step because they wanted to make it into a sleepover. And I think they had this vision of, you know, all sitting around the equivalent of the campfire and they getting to ask me questions about what it was like to be a woman scientist. And they had us in the different pavilions, and I was in the shark pavilion. But they fed these middle school girls pizza, soda, and ice cream. And then they just let them loose. And I'd have written a check for $1,000 for somebody to teleport me out of there. It was so awful. We do need to think these things through just a little bit more. I think the long-term mentoring is much more beneficial.
Well, unfortunately, it's 8:45, and we have to draw this to an end. I think, as I said at the beginning, you can see that this has been a wonderful session with these fascinating women, and we could probably sit here and talk all day. Sylvia,
well, just one final thought of why it matters. When I applied to be a part of a project of living underwater for a couple of weeks to be an aquanaut, head of the program who had to decide whether women should be a part of it or not because they hadn't expected women to apply, solved the problem in an instant when he said, "Well, half the fish are female. I guess we can put up with a few women."
Any other final thoughts since no one's kicking us out of the...
Well, it matters because it's good for the bottom line. It's good for the health of the country.
Yes.
And we're ranked 25th out of a pool of 40 countries in terms
Science
of STEM.
Matters.
And
yeah.
So the competitiveness of America is at stake here.
Yeah, you said it very well.
You're here.
Yeah.
Thank you very much for coming.
Thank you,
Thank you very much.